Hello, folks. Before we begin tonight, I would hope that after you spend some time with me tonight, to be sure and check out the other podcasts on the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Don't miss the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights podcasts, hosted by my very good friend Steve Taylor, airing on Tuesdays. And, of course, don't forget Fear from the Heartland by Paul J. McSorley, Horror Hill with Eric Peabody, and Drew Blood's Dark Tales. You can find them all at simplyscarypodcast.com, on YouTube, or your favorite podcasting service. Or be sure to visit the ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com website and become a patron and hear extended episodes from our vast audio archive. Join us for a while, won't you?
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyrie, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 12, Episode 17. I'm your host, Otis Chari, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of author Thomas O. Tonight, we'll hear stories of pernicious punishments, extremely lost limbs, and unfriendly games. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start. But now, all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Seems like there was a time when anyone could be accused of anything. There wasn't a whole lot you could do if found guilty. Our first story of the night, in which Carl Wilhelm has been sentenced to death in a most cruel and unusual way. And yet, he doesn't seem as if he will be finding relief anytime soon. It may just take a young boy's strange interest to finally bring peace. Without further ado, I present to you the Well, the Wheel, and Wilhelm. Carl Wilhelm's left arm was the first limb that was smashed. The executioner's club shattered it with enough force so that witnesses in the back of the crowd could hear the cracking sound clearly. He cried out in agony as he laid across the span of an old wagon wheel. His limbs were tied fast to the wheel's edge, and its spokes supported his body. The wheel itself was atop an old, unused well, and Carl stared heavenward as the executioner, encouraged and energized by the whooping and cheering of the crowd, dragged the large club along the ground as he positioned himself at Carl's right side. With all his strength, the masked executioner brought the heavy instrument up above his head, and as the club reached its peak, the crowd paused in anxious anticipation. The club fell down, cracking Carl's right arm under the blow. The crowd responded with an uproarious cheer. The man in the mask moved along to each of Carl's legs, breaking them both above and below the knee. Bone protruded through the torn skin. His blood dripped through the ruptures and into the well below. The crowd screamed their approval and threw rotten fruit at the condemned man. The executioner removed his mask and raised his arms to encourage the crowd to cheer further. His last strike landed on Carl's chest, breaking several of his ribs. Blood erupted from his mouth and nose. With that, the executioner dropped the club and stepped away from the well. From the back of the crowd, a boy of about 10 studied Carl's gasping form. "He's still alive," the boy said to his uncle. "It's all part of the punishment, Victor," his uncle responded. "He'll lay there in pain. Death will take him when it's ready. I've never seen a man who lasted past sunset." The boy continued to study the dying man through the other onlookers, many of whom were taking turns spitting and urinating on Carl. Victor recalled the list of charges that Carl Wilhelm had been accused of. "What's lycanthropy?" he asked of his uncle. "It means he can become a wolf. It's the mark of a wicked man." Victor nodded his understanding. "Can we stay and watch him die?" "I have work to do, but you can stay until sunset. Don't forget I need your help tonight at the tavern." "I'll be there," Victor assured him. As his uncle walked away, Victor could hear the broken man plead to the crowd with strained breaths. "Please, just kill me." This only encouraged the horde more, and they jeered and roared at his predicament. However, as the afternoon heat began to take on its toll, the excitement of the crowd began to wane. One by one, the men and women left for the cottages and hovels, until only Victor and a few others remained. The boy stepped closer to the dying man, with uncertainty apparent in each step. When he got as close as he dared, he pursed his lips and launched a phlegm projectile that struck Carl between his eyes. With great effort, Carl turned his head to where Victor stood. The two made eye contact.
"So thirsty," Carl rasped.
Victor stared at the face of the accused man. Each of Carl's brown eyes reflected the swirling white clouds above him. Longer and longer, Victor stared, losing track of time and relinquishing awareness of his surroundings. He had no idea how long he maintained eye contact with Carl Wilhelm, but when he finally broke his stare, it was almost sunset, and the village square was nearly empty. Victor backed away from the wheel and its man, and as he headed off to his uncle's tavern, he felt a twinge of regret that he had spit on someone so defenseless. His uncle's prediction that Carl would be dead by sunset proved to be entirely wrong. Those who lived nearest to the old well had their slumbers disturbed throughout the night as Carl screamed and moaned. His pleas for mercy and death went unanswered as the village residents held pillows and blankets over their heads in an attempt to drown out the horrid sounds of the dying man. All through the next day, Carl continued with ungodly shrieks and screeches as death refused to take him. Residents, who just a day earlier had made merriment at the man's suffering,
soon found themselves anxious and disconcerted as his cries carried on throughout the day and into the next. "Go get the executioner," some of them demanded. "Have him finish his job." Others argued against that. "No, he'll die when he's supposed to. No mercy for the wicked." On the third night after his supposed execution, Carl Wilhelm still appeared to be very much alive, as proven by his unceasing cries of pain and requests for mercy. From his uncle's tavern, Victor could hear him clearly between pauses in the conversations. Frazzled patrons lined the bar and occupied all the tables as Victor weaved in and out, bringing mugs to the tap for refilling and then returning them to the customers. Various discussions about the man outside dominated the night, and fear punctuated the dialogue, as the men nervously proclaimed to understand what was going on. "Hell doesn't want him. That's why he won't die," proclaimed Peter the shoemaker. Others raised their mugs in nervous agreement. "I don't think he's guilty at all," came a response from across the room. The men all paused and looked at Conrad Becker, one of the village's oldest men. "We're being punished, forced to listen to the cries of an innocent man until we ourselves go insane." "How could he possibly be innocent?" others demanded. I looked him in the eyes, and I know the stare of innocence. The tavern became hushed as Conrad Becker spoke. "And why should we believe the allegations against him? Did anyone observe him turn into a wolf?" Well, the men all looked at each other, waiting to see who among them would stand up as a witness. "The judges on the council are only interested in making a name for themselves. The truth doesn't concern them." Victor's uncle spoke up. "Then who tore apart Walter Ernst? And who ripped his daughter's head off? A giant wolf was seen walking on two legs outside of Carl's farm. His hatred of Walter was well known." "That's close enough for me. Who else could it have been?" Cheers of agreement supported him. Conrad protested. "That's not real evidence. Lots of people didn't like Walter Ernst. Some of them are in this bar right now." "Then who is the lycanthrope if it's not Carl Wilhelm?" the men asked as they began to break into smaller discussions amongst themselves. They argued late into the night. Most seemed to agree that Carl Wilhelm was indeed guilty, but a few maintained his innocence. As the crowd dwindled, Victor said goodnight to his uncle and headed home. The trip was interrupted by the moaning of Carl Wilhelm. Victor's paces stopped, and after a moment's hesitation, he turned and walked toward the well, the wheel, and Wilhelm. As he approached, Wilhelm's ears twitched, and he seemed to sense Victor's presence.
"Water,"
came his strained request. Victor hesitated.
"So thirsty,"
he said in a raspy voice that was barely above a whisper. Victor viewed the pathetic form in front of them, and a stitch of sympathy took hold. He looked at the dewy ground and saw a small dirty puddle where the night's condensation had collected. Glancing behind him to make sure no one was looking, Victor made a cup with his hands and bent down to gather as much of the water as he could. He carefully stood up and moved his hands over Carl's mouth. As he loosened his fingers, the water flowed down and dribbled into Carl's delirious maw. He repeated the act of mercy two more times, until the puddle gave up no more water.
"Thank you."
Victor noticed that Carl's voice was noticeably less raspy.
"You're welcome."
Carl stared up into the starry night and enjoyed the sensation of a wet throat. Eventually, he spoke again to Victor. "My father taught me to never let a debt go unpaid, but I have nothing I can give you except for advice." He paused for a moment to think. "Always remember that the world exists in shades of gray." Victor contemplated what was told of him, but failed to understand what the man was getting at. Without saying anything more, he backed away slowly and left for home. Soon, any relief that had been visited upon Carl was gone, and his screams and wails started up. In their homes, the residents spent another night trying their best not to hear it. Carl held strong throughout the next day. His pleas were ignored, but not unheard, and nearly everyone within earshot was noticeably on edge. His gangrenous legs, chapped skin, and sallow features made him appear as something other than human to those few who wandered over to look. That night, many of the residents again gathered within the tavern, thankful that the activity of the crowded room was able to drown out the noise from the man on the wheel. Ironically, they spent most of their evening talking about the very man they were trying to get away from. The arguments from the previous night were far from settled, and Victor listened as the inebriated men took up their positions once again. Only a wolfman could survive out there this long, some claimed. Conrad Becker, the primary defender of Carl's innocence, shot back, "If he was a wolf, he would have changed into one by now. Clearly he's just a man, and only a man." Victor tuned them out. The beers he brought to the men kept them slaked and heated at the same time. Soon, the air in the room grew thick, so Victor was glad when his uncle allowed him to take a break. He stepped outside into the fresh air and took some deep breaths. The first thing he noticed is that the night was quiet. Curiously, he walked over to the village square to check on the condition of Carl Wilhelm. The man was still breathing.
"Victor! Victor, is that you?"
the condemned man asked as he approached. Victor hadn't realized that Carl even knew his name.
"Yes, it's me. Thirsty."
Victor reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out a flask that he had filled earlier with water. He opened it and held it over Carl's mouth, allowing the liquid to slowly dribble its way down.
"Oh, that tastes good,"
Carl said. The two of them waited in silence as the man slowly regained some sense of humanity.
"And now I must repay you."
He stared at the heavens thoughtfully. "You will be better off in life to forgive past transgressions." Victor considered the advice and took his leave before anyone saw him talking to the living dead man. Carl's screams began again shortly thereafter. Day broke and the residents tried their best to carry on with their normal activities, but they found themselves becoming more and more irritable as Carl's moans pierced their ears and penetrated their minds. A small group of men, led by Conrad Becker, gathered in the village square. A few of them believed in Carl's innocence, while the others had simply had enough of this loud suffering and were anxious to see it end.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
"That man should be put out of his misery," Conrad declared with an axe in his hand. The men nodded and hummed their agreement. With raucous cheers, they headed to the wheel. Victor, who was preparing his uncle's tavern for the night, heard the unfolding scene and went outside just in time to see Conrad lift the axe above his head, poised to strike down on Carl's skull. Even from across the way, Victor could see Carl's muscles relax, relieved that a finishing stroke was only moments away. Before Conrad could bring the axe down, the thunder of fast-approaching footsteps was heard.
"Don't you dare end that man's life!"
came a scream from behind Victor. It was Hans Stein, a prominent village leader who had sat on the council that found Carl guilty of lycanthropy. He was accompanied by several other men.
"Can't you see what's in front of you?"
Conrad protested as the second group of men made their way toward the well. He hesitantly lowered his axe.
"Look,
This is no longer a man, but a miserable wretch. Have you no mercy? Hans arrived at the well. I agree that this is no man, but a wretch he is not. He's a wolf. God or the devil will take him when they're ready. Conrad gave a once-over to the tortured man in front of him. Flies buzzed above the rotten flesh on Carl's legs. Deep cracks spread out over his skin like spiderwebs, revealing dried musculature underneath. His eyes appeared to have sunken deep into his skull, and his limbs were contorted at odd angles. With resolve, Conrad lifted his axe back up with a shout. Death is his only choice now, and the quicker the better. Before he could land a strike, two burly men came up from behind Hans and grabbed onto Conrad, slamming him to the ground. The head of the axe fell onto Conrad's leg, causing a long gash to form along his shin. For a tense moment, it appeared as if the two groups of men were going to come to blows, but the determination of Conrad's group wavered as they all took turns waiting for someone else to act first. In the end, they only stared at each other, ashamed. Hans took advantage of the lack of leadership within the rival group and spoke loudly. There will be no intervening. All of you leave before you're arrested. He directed the two burly men to drag a semi-conscious Conrad away from the well. Please, came the scraping voice of the man on the wheel. Hans ignored the pleas and waited while the group dispersed. When he was sure the mob had disbanded, he too left, and Carl was alone in his agony. His pain moaning began yet again as the sun beat down on him. Victor had watched the scene unfold with conflicted feelings, but soon he retreated back into his uncle's tavern where they were preparing for the nightly crowd. Uncle, do you really think that man is guilty of being a wolf? I believe in the council, his uncle replied. They say he's guilty, therefore he's guilty. And good for business, he added with a chuckle. He looked closer at Victor. You don't think he's innocent, do you? You must take those concerns and bury them if you do. Yes, uncle, came the reserved reply. Carl Wilhelm was indeed good for business, and that night the tavern was as full as it ever had been. It was only in the late hours that Victor had a chance to slip away. He stepped out of the tavern and into the cool air. Across the square, he could see Carl lying across the well. A low hum was emanating from his lungs, but it ceased as Victor approached.
Victor, is that you?
Carl asked with a wheezy whisper. His eyes, which were pointed directly up to the sky, were completely dried out and lifeless. Without saying a word, Victor removed a flask and attempted to pour some water into Carl's mouth. Carl shook him off.
Save it. I'm beyond thirsty now.
Victor lowered his arms dejectedly, and both the man and boy remained silent in the cool night air. Victor could hear the crickets chirping for the first time in days. It was almost entrancing.
Victor, do you know where my house is?
Carl asked the surprised boy. And Victor took pause at the odd question, but affirmed with a murmur that he knew where the house was. The visit from the boy seemed to energize Carl, and he spoke clearly.
Good. I have one more favor to ask of you.
In the corner of the bedroom, there's a loose floorboard. If you lift it up inside, you will find a common belt, just like the one you're wearing, to keep your pants up. Victor glanced down at his leather belt.
Please, will you retrieve it for me?
Carl asked with a cough. Victor scratched his head.
What do you want with a belt? How can it help you?
It was made for me by my wife nearly 20 years ago, right before she died. It's one of the only things I still have that reminds me of her. I believe she'll find me and guide me into the afterlife if I wear it. The boy looked at the pathetic man in front of him, who wanted nothing more than to die, then glanced back at the tavern, where the libations were still flowing freely, and he knew he was needed.
I can't leave right now.
The sounds of vigorous arguing filtered through the walls of the tavern and littered the night air. Carl allowed the sounds to envelop him before speaking.
I promise. Those men inside won't be angry with you.
Then Carl sweetened the deal. There are some gold coins hidden alongside the belt. They can be yours.
Victor considered his options. He knew his uncle would be upset if he was gone too long, but the promise of the coins intrigued him.
I can get it for you later tonight, he offered. I've waited here long enough, Victor. My house is only minutes away if you run fast.
The moon shone down upon the two of them as Victor finally agreed to the request.
He wasted no time as he bolted off.
His feet carried him quickly to the outskirts of the village and then beyond. Down the trail he ran as the trees and thickets grew denser around him. Soon he found Carl's farmhouse, which had been abandoned since his jailing. He pushed on the front door, which creaked as it slowly opened. The house was completely dark inside, which forced Victor to inch his way to a window and push aside the ratty curtains. Bits of moonlight streamed into the room, barely enough for him to see. He crept further in until he made it into the back room of the home. The rickety floor bent under his weight as he shuffled to the only unfurnished corner in the room. He knelt down to feel for a loose floorboard, while the smell of dust kicked his nose. He methodically felt each board until a loose one moved in his fingers. He eagerly moved it out of his way and jammed his hand down into the murky hole. His fingers felt the belt immediately. He pulled it out and put his hand back inside, looking for the gold coins which he'd been promised, but he felt nothing more within the hole. Disappointed, he reached further in, feeling along the dirty crevices. It was only emptiness. Victor knelt in the darkness, mulling over his situation. Had Carl lied to him about the gold, he wondered, or had someone already come along and taken it? Either way, he knew his uncle was going to be furious, and he had nothing to show for his absence. He grabbed the belt and inched his way out of the gloomy dwelling and pushed through the woods on his way back to town. He arrived back at the village square, out of breath and exhausted. On his run back, he made the decision to bypass Carl and return directly to the tavern. But as he approached, the renewed moaning from atop the well gave him pause. He still had sympathy for the tortured man. The moaning stopped as Victor approached. "Do you have the belt?" Carl asked. "There was no gold," the boy sputtered. "I'm sorry, I lied to you about the gold," Carl replied between obvious bouts of suffering. "I had no choice." Disillusionment crept along Victor's face. "Please forgive me, Victor. I ask one last thing of you. Put the belt around my waist." Victor, who only wanted to go back to the tavern, decided to give the man his one last request and then be done with him for good. He climbed on top of the well and reached his hand under the man's back, threading the belt under and then over him. He closed the buckle and then jumped down from the well and started walking back toward the tavern.
"Victor,"
came the suddenly much stronger voice of Carl Wilhelm. "Have you thought much about the advice I gave you?" The boy stopped in surprise at how much stronger the man sounded. He ran through his previous conversations with Carl. Shades of gray, forgiving past transgressions. Wasn't sure what it all meant. "You see, Victor, I was a good man, but I still wanted to see Walter Ernst dead. He attacked my wife many years ago and never paid for his crimes. He was too close to the village council." Victor returned to the well and noticed that Carl's eyes were no longer sunken into his skull. In fact, his entire face looked much healthier. "So I called to the devil, and it took years, but he answered. I wanted Walter Ernst to pay for his deeds in the most horrible way." Carl's deflated muscles began regaining their form. "It was he who gave me the belt, not my wife. Again, I'm sorry, I had to lie to you." Victor took a step back as he saw the broken bones in Carl's leg straighten out and heal. Carl continued, "And when the deed was done, I was ashamed of myself because I killed his daughter, too. When they came to arrest me, I allowed it. I could have gotten away." The wheel began cracking under the strain as Carl's growing limbs pushed against its rim. Carl's voice grew deeper, "And I waited here for days, hoping for a death that refused to come.
It finally became apparent to me that God won't have me, and the devil thinks I still have more work to do. In the moonlight, it appeared to Victor that Carl's very face seemed to be contorting into something different. So I'll do his work. Coarse gray hair began growing upon his body as Victor sat frozen in fear. Carl's voice had attained a deep, animalistic growl.
You've done me one last favor, and as before, I can only repay you with advice.
He turned his head and stared at the boy. His eyes were yellow.
Run.
Victor fell backward onto his bottom and crawled away when he heard the wooden wheel begin to break apart. He finally stood up and heeded the advice, running away beyond the boundary of the village. The wagon wheel splintered to pieces as the man attached to it doubled in size. His body contorted to a wolfen shape as he stepped down from the well and howled. Walking on 2 feet, the beast approached the tavern, while inside, a sudden confused silence fell over the men. For the most part, they were the same ones who had laughed at Carl, the same ones who had spit and pissed on him, the same ones who had allowed his suffering to go on unabated. Carl owed them for 5 days of torture and agony, and as he entered the tavern through its only door, a single thought on his primitive mind was that he should never let a debt go unpaid. I hope you enjoyed The Well, The Wheel, and Wilhelm by Thomas O, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed the tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Thomas-O. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Thomas-O. Find short story collections of his on Amazon, but you can also enjoy his work in the Chilling Tales Anthology Volume 1, available in print, ebook, and soon in audiobook. If you do decide to stop by the profile, please leave him a kind word and let him know you heard about him here on this show and that Otis sent you. It would mean a lot to me. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. I'm so glad Carl finally got his peace of mind, though I think some of those in the tavern will want those pieces back. Well, perhaps there's someone who could lend him a hand, if he hadn't already lost it. Seems, though, that losing a limb means gaining a friend, or at least a new acquaintance from somewhere beyond the veil. Without further ado, I present to you the Phantom Arm of Sebastian Culpepper. I have 2 stories I want to tell. In each one, the main character is missing an arm. Other than that, both of these tales are quite different from one another. Yet, I can't seem to separate the two in my mind, as they seem to complement each other in peculiar and disturbing ways. Our first story, the much shorter of the two, was passed on to me by my father. It starts in 1910 and goes like this. A mill employee named Gerald Parsons suffered an unfortunate workplace accident when he stepped a little too close to the grinding equipment. The mill's gears, as strong as they were unforgiving, ripped Gerald's arm clean from his body. Surprisingly, he not only survived the accident, but he lived another 40 years, working in that same mill until the day he died of natural causes. Beginning shortly after his death, if you're prone to believing the rumors, the ghost of Gerald Parsons could still sometimes be seen walking the floor of the mill. In addition to the sightings, there exists a fuzzy photograph from 1965 that purportedly shows his eerie form walking through the grinding room. Not too long after that picture was taken, the mill was torn down. Shortly after that, Gerald Parsons' existence became one based only on the memories of others, as his ghost was never seen again. Now, here's the most interesting thing about this story. All of the eyewitnesses who saw Gerald's ghost claimed that he had two arms. My father was one of those witnesses, and he too swore that on the night Gerald appeared to him, both his upper limbs were intact. Even the fuzzy picture shows a possibly grinning Gerald with two equally fuzzy arms down by his side. So I ask you, how is it that a man who lived two-thirds of his life without his left arm suddenly reunited with it upon death? The question is completely rhetorical, because neither you nor I can know the real answer. Yet it happened. It's almost as if his arm preceded him to the afterlife, and somehow waited there for the rest of him to catch up. Silly, right? I suppose I wouldn't have put too much thought into Gerald's story if I had never known my friend Sebastian Culpepper. If you compare Sebastian and Gerald, you'll find very few attributes in common. Gerald, earnest, hardworking, and serious. Sebastian, fun-loving, loyal, and friendly. Yet, as I touched on earlier, they do share one major quality. Both lost their left arm at a relatively young age, and that brings us to our second story. When Sebastian was 17, a heavy crate fell on his arm while he was moving some items around his attic. The injury seemed minor at first, but an unfortunate and uncommon cascade of events followed. The injury began to swell up. The swelling cut off the circulation to his arm. Then his arm tissue began to die. The pain finally forced Sebastian to the emergency room, but not soon enough. 2 days after the injury, his arm was amputated. It's quite common for an amputee to still feel a limb after it's been removed. It's as if the brain still thinks the limb's attached. Phenomenon is referred to as phantom limb syndrome. Upon waking from his surgery, Sebastian could have sworn that his left arm was still present, but it was just a trick his body was playing on itself. Not only could he feel his missing arm, but it hurt too. Sebastian adjusted as best he could, and he was determined not to let his missing arm prevent him from accomplishing his goals in life. However, the pain and discomfort associated with his phantom limb was ever present. There were different therapies that Sebastian subjected himself to, and there were painkillers, too. The treatments helped somewhat, and slowly, over the course of years, phantom limb pain improved for Sebastian, though it never went away entirely. I never knew Sebastian when he had two arms. I met him years after his accident, and we both worked in the same office. I used to tell him that he was the coolest one-armed guy in the world. I'd have even been right about that. Clients loved him, and he always got a laugh by going to shake their hands and then acting like he didn't know where his arm had gone off to. Corny, yes, but somehow Sebastian made it funny every single time. The bosses all adored him, too, and I can't really think of anyone who didn't like him. So it was odd when Sebastian came to work one particular Monday in a foul mood. I watched him the entire morning, uncharacteristically snapping at people for making minor mistakes and generally being a jerk. Rather than see him get himself in some sort of trouble with the higher-ups, I suggested he and I leave early for the lunch. "Yeah, Brian, that sounds like a good idea," he told me. "Let's get out of here." It was at the restaurant when he finally clued me in as to what had been bothering him. "It's my arm," he said between bites of his hamburger. "It's hurting me. A lot." I looked at his right arm, the only one he still had. "No," he shook his head, "my other arm." "You've had phantom limb pain before," I argued. "You didn't go around acting like a complete asshole when it happened." "It's different this time." He took another bite before putting his burger down. "It's not random pain like in the past. I feel specific." He trailed off as he tried to think of the right words. "Things." "Things?" I asked. "I don't know. I don't think I know what you mean." "When I was younger, the pain was always generalized. It started here." Sebastian pointed to where his left forearm should have been. "Then it moved up toward my shoulder. But now it feels like there's something sharp stabbing me. I tell you, it's very specific. It's not like anything I've felt before. He sighed and looked right at me.
And it hurts.
Even though I clearly heard him, I still sought some clarification.
You're talking about your missing arm. It feels like it's being stabbed.
Yeah. Stabbing, cutting. It's like someone trying to torture me.
Do you feel it right now?
He shook his head no. Usually it starts around 6 p.m. and goes for about a half hour or so. It's been like this for the past few days.
I wasn't sure what to tell him,
but I wanted to be supportive of my friend. Hey, the Lakers are on tonight, I told him. I'll head over to your place around 6 and we can watch together. He had a distracted look on his face as if he hadn't heard me. Hey, I prodded. I'll bring the beer. Sebastian's stern face broke and he gave a small smile.
Sure, man. Sounds good.
I got out of work late. Sebastian had gone home early at my suggestion. So I finished up some of his loose ends. By the time I got to my house and changed clothes, it was already nearing 6 o'clock. Traffic took up more time, and the line at the convenience store was anything but convenient. As I arrived at his apartment complex with beer in hand, I cursed myself for not getting there sooner. I bound up the stairs to Sebastian's apartment two at a time. When I knocked on his door, there was only dead silence from the other side. I waited a minute, then let myself in with a twist of the handle. Sebastian was lying silently on the couch. His eyes were scrunched shut, and the trails of wetness on his cheek gave evidence of the tears that had run down his face moments earlier.
Sebastian, you okay?
He nodded silently, not to say he was okay, but to acknowledge my presence. I put the case of beer on the coffee table and stood by awkwardly. He finally spoke to me.
I'm scared. It feels like the skin is being pulled off my arm.
A scream erupted from his mouth as he rolled off the couch onto the floor. I stepped forward to help him up, but he waved me away.
I'll go grab you a Percocet, I said as I changed direction toward the bathroom, where I knew he kept his pain medication.
No, I already took a couple. They're not helping. With nothing left to do, I stood and waited helplessly, as my friend struggled with his pain. For maybe 15 minutes more, he grimaced in agony, occasionally screaming out. Eventually, I could see a look of relief spread across his face as the pain ebbed.
It stopped, he said.
Maybe the Percocets worked, I ventured. No, he responded. I think whatever it is, it's done for the night. Sebastian got back on the couch and motioned for me to sit down with him.
Man, it's the craziest thing, he continued. When I'm in all that pain, it feels like someone's there with a hand grabbing onto my phantom arm.
He paused for a moment after seeing my face, which must have had a strange look on it.
Hey, thanks for coming out tonight. It's nice to have someone here.
Yeah, no problem, Bast. Have you seen a doctor about this pain?
Not since this started, but I don't know what else they can do for me that they haven't already tried.
He reached for a beer and opened it before picking it up. Then he took a good long drink. He wiped his mouth before continuing. I looked it up online to see if anyone else has experienced pain exactly like this, but I couldn't find anything. I stayed with Sebastian for a couple more hours. We just talked like good friends do. It took his mind off of what he was going through. On my way out for the night, I told him that I'd be back the next evening and that I'd try to get there earlier. That night, as I tried to sleep, I found it impossible not to envision the pained look I'd seen on Sebastian's face earlier that evening. The situation simply wasn't normal, and it worried me. What was causing my friend such pain? How was it possible for such a long-gone limb to have an effect on his current well-being? Finally, after lying awake and pondering the situation for hours, I willed myself to stop thinking about it. As I faded off, the story of Gerald Parsons swirled in my mind for just a moment, then sleep. Work was busy the next day, and I barely had time to acknowledge Sebastian's presence at the office. So I was glad when, later that evening,
I was able to keep my word and arrive at his apartment 20 minutes before 6. Sebastian had already taken 2 Percocets in anticipation of what was to come, even though he seemed to believe they didn't help. I brought Chinese food, which I put on his dining room table. As I pulled out the paper plates, I asked a question that had popped into my head as I drifted off the night before. "So, what do you think your arm is?" A look of confusion spread across Sebastian's face. "The arm they cut off? I don't know. What do they do with medical waste?" "That's not exactly what I'm talking about." I felt foolish for what I was about to say, but I think Sebastian already knew where my line of questioning was headed. "I'm not talking about your physical arm. No, I mean, where do you think its spirit went?" Sebastian managed to force out a meager laugh. I don't think arms had spirits of their own." He didn't sound convincing, as if maybe he'd already had this same conversation with himself. Knowing his fragile state, I tried to be gentle with my words. "Well, maybe that was a bad way to phrase it. But what if it's still part of your overall spirit, and it's out there waiting for you, somewhere?" Sebastian laughed even harder at that. "Don't laugh," I said. "I'm serious. My dad used to tell me a story about a man who lost an arm just like you did. After he died, people saw his ghost, and it had 2 arms." Sebastian sat down at the table. "So you're saying that my ghost arm is out there, floating around in some nether region just waiting for me to reunite with it?" "Well, it sounds stupid when you say it out loud like that." I was suddenly embarrassed at my idea. "Not stupid. I appreciate the fact that you're putting some thought into this. But if what you're saying is true, then that would mean my arm is waiting for me in some place that probably isn't so nice." He faded off as the implication of what he was saying sunk in. I shook my head and tried to change the subject. "No, it was just a stupid thought I had. Sorry I brought it up. Your arm's not waiting for you. That would be ridiculous." Sebastian was silent. I could see that the idea was gaining traction in his thoughts. Finally, he looked at his watch. "It's almost 6. The pain came to him, the same as it had the night before. Once again, I waited, helplessly, while my friend writhed in agony. Sebastian, in a tortured voice, was able to describe the pain as it happened. Stabbing sensations, bones in his fingers getting snapped, a sharp instrument slicing along the length of his arm, and something grabbing onto him. After some minutes of extreme pain, it seemed he was given a temporary reprieve. "I don't feel any stabbing or breaking," he said, "but I still feel warmth, like my arm's in some sort of really hot room." A new thought popped in my head. "Why don't you try to move your arm?" I asked. "Maybe this thing works 2 ways. Maybe it won't hurt so much if you can mentally shift its position." "What do you mean?" His interest was piqued. "How would I do that?" "Use your muscle memory. Just imagine that your arm's still attached and then act on it. Move your fingers or something." Sebastian nodded, indicating that he took the idea seriously. Personally, I thought it was a crazy idea, but it matched the crazy situation. I gave no credence to the fact that it might actually work. Sebastian closed his eyes and concentrated. "Okay, I'll wait until I feel something, then I'll try." We sat in silence as the clock seemed to tick endlessly. Sebastian was focused and at the ready. I twiddled my fingers, beginning to regret both the fact that I'd made such a silly suggestion and that he'd bought into it. "Look, Sebastian, maybe it's done for the night." I was suddenly cut off by Sebastian's cries as the torture restarted. "God damn!" The expletives flew from his mouth as he squirmed on the couch. It seemed like for just a second he'd forgotten his plan of attack, but then he composed himself and gave me a nod. I could see the muscles of his stub flex as he made his motion. When I saw what happened next, I jumped from a sitting position and
stood up on the couch, screaming out loud in shock and surprise. Sebastian had gotten launched from the couch. In fact, it looked more like he'd been pulled off of it. He landed on the floor face first, then his whole body moved along the ground toward the other side of the living room. His stub was leading the way. I saw the look of terror in his face as he was dragged to the other side of the apartment by something unseen. He finally came to a stop next to the wall. "What happened?" I asked between breaths. I grabbed it. Sebastian was breathing too heavily to say anything more. I got up off the couch and helped him up. He walked back and sat down, and when he spoke, there was a trembling in his voice. "I actually felt my hand as it latched onto some sort of creature. Its skin was hot and rough, and it pulled back when I grabbed it. Probably I surprised it, and it dragged me until I let go." Faced with indisputable proof that something supernatural was happening, I began shaking all over. I tried to imagine a way that it could just be a trick that Sebastian was playing, but the way he moved across the ground, no man could move like that on his own. I'd seen it firsthand. He'd been dragged. I suddenly wanted to be anywhere else. "I gotta get out of here, Sebastian. This is just too real." I walked quickly to the front door and opened it. "I don't think you should try that again. I'll call you later." I had no intention of calling him. "Wait, please, don't leave me alone." Sebastian looked desperate. "I'll admit it. I'm terrified, Brian." "Yeah, I am too. That's why I'm leaving. Just don't do that again. Take another Percocet and go to sleep. Everything will be all right." Even as I spoke the words, I knew they were lies. Fear was firmly in control as I walked out the door. I just wanted to be alone before yet another new reality reared up and dragged my friend across the room. I raced home, turning my phone off before I even got there. I tried to sleep, but the sight of Sebastian being dragged across the room by some unknown specter kept replaying in my mind. To say I got 2 hours of sleep that night would be generous, so I called in sick to work the next morning. That whole day I tried to keep busy. I watched television, took some naps, read a book, and did basically anything to keep my mind occupied. As the day waned, I began thinking more and more about Sebastian, despite my efforts otherwise. I intentionally kept my phone off for the entire day. After sunset, I held the device in my hand and went through the motions of turning it on without actually doing so. I knew that once I powered it back up, I'd no longer be able to ignore the new world that had been opened to me. I eventually gathered the strength to turn it on. Not more than 3 minutes later, I got a call from Sebastian. "Come over, please, now." I was desperate. "What's the problem?" I tried to be strong, but I immediately regretted answering his call. I could hear the horror in his voice as he answered. "It started communicating with me." I quickly sat up. "What? How?" "It's spelling things on my arm. Just get over here, please." I gathered my final bit of courage and headed over to Sebastian's apartment. He let me in as soon as I got there. "It's writing things to me." I could see a tear in his eye. "I can feel its claw, or whatever it is, cutting the words into my arm letter by letter." "What's it saying?" Sebastian showed me a notepad that he'd written on. Once I figured out what was happening, I started to write down the letters. I looked at the pad and saw what he'd scribbled. "Death. Soon. Wait for you. Mine." "What's doing this to me?" Sebastian quietly asked. "I don't know, but whatever it is, it can't spell." Sebastian looked at me incredulously and hit the notepad out of my hand. "Who cares if it's a bad speller? It's damn good at causing me agony." I apologized to him if it had just been a stupid comment, meant to mask the true fear I felt. I picked up the notebook and looked at it again.
So this thing, it's communicating with you now.
Yes.
It was solemn. But why today? Why would this thing start sending you messages only now?
I wondered that too, he replied. I think the link between me and my phantom arm is growing stronger.
This thing couldn't do it before because the connection wasn't sensitive enough for me to feel the words. He looked down at his shoes.
But now it is. When I grabbed it, it learned that the link was getting stronger.
Getting stronger? Why would it be doing that?
I motioned down to the notepad in my hands.
You saw it. Death soon. The closer I get to death, the stronger the link to my arms become.
I shook my head. You don't know that. You can't be sure.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
I nodded grimly. I couldn't think of a better explanation.
Is it still talking to you? Sebastian shook his head. Not anymore. I think it's done for the night.
Sebastian was right. The thing, whatever it was that was communicating with him, didn't hurt him again that night. I went to work the next day, but my recent inability to focus on anything remained with me. I'm sure I must have lost an account due to my distracted mind, but it didn't even matter to me. Sebastian called out sick, which he certainly couldn't be blamed for. I held off calling him during the day for the simple reason I had no idea what to say to him. When work was done, I made the uncharacteristically bold decision to go straight to his apartment. If I went home, I knew I was unlikely to go over to Sebastian's ever again. I was scared, yes, but I knew that if I were in his position, Sebastian would never let me go through something like that alone. I picked up a pizza on the way over. When I got there, I saw a smidgen of relief grace Sebastian's face when he answered the door. He motioned me in with a sweeping arm gesture, then stepped into his living room and fell backward onto the couch. I set the pizza down on the table and offered Sebastian a slice as I picked up one for myself. He shook his head no. The room was quiet, except for the ticking of the clock and my chewing, which I was quickly becoming aware of. With the silence getting uncomfortable, I thought of something to ask. Sebastian, why do you think this is happening to you? He looked away from me. Lots of people who lose their arm have phantom limb pain. Yeah, but they don't get dragged across the room. I was shocked that he could somehow respond, as if he was going through what was common phantom limb pain. Sebastian didn't respond, and instead he nodded toward the clock on the wall. 6 o'clock. He picked up the same notepad from the night before and placed it on the end table next to him and then grabbed his pen. With his eyes closed and in deep concentration, he was ready to write any messages that came through. The next couple of minutes passed by uneventfully, but soon I could see Sebastian visibly begin to struggle with increasing pain. Beads of sweat formed on the side of his head, and his breathing quickened. It's starting? I cautiously asked.
Sebastian nodded.
Yeah, and my head hurts, too.
A headache? That's new, isn't it? Sebastian nodded yes again and screamed out, it's cutting into my arm. Even with the pain, Sebastian focused inward and began recording the letters that were being cut into his long-lost limb.
Hello, Bren.
I stared at the paper, and I screamed as Sebastian marked the final N across the paper. Sebastian's pseudo-trance was broken by my outburst.
It's talking to me. I yelled as I pointed at the writing. Hello, Brian.
I jumped away from the couch.
How does it know my name? How does it know I'm here?
I don't know, man. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have dragged you into this.
Sebastian held his hand to his eyes as an apparent wave of pain pulsed through his head.
That's it. I'm leaving.
I grabbed my jacket and headed for the door.
Wait, Sebastian pleaded. You asked why this was happening.
It's about Carla Shavers.
It's the only possible reason. I think I'm being punished.
Who's that?
I demanded with my hand on the doorknob. Just look it up later. I'm sorry it ever happened. He looked ashamed as the words left his mouth. I pulled the door open and took one last look at Sebastian. Please don't leave me alone, he cried. His left eyelid pulsed as he spoke. Tears streamed from his other eye. I'll call you tomorrow. It was the last lie I'd ever tell Sebastian. I closed the apartment door behind me and walked quickly away. As I moved down the hallway, I heard Sebastian scream out. I walked faster. He wasn't at work the next day, nor did he call our supervisor to say he wouldn't be in. I turned my cell phone off just in case he tried to call me. I felt guilty about it, but I wasn't too far from having a breakdown of my own. I mindlessly went through the motions of my job. I didn't go see Sebastian that night. The day after, his corpse was found by another one of our co-workers who went to his apartment to check on him. The news was devastating for me. He'd been a great friend, one who'd never let me down. The sense of loss was compounded by the knowledge that I'd abandoned him in his time of need. Even worse than that, I knew that the entity that once had only his arm probably now had him in his entirety. I vomited the first time that thought entered my mind. Sebastian's body didn't have a mark on it. It took time. But eventually, the medical examiner determined that his death was due to natural causes, a ruptured brain aneurysm specifically. It was a condition Sebastian never knew he had. The time of death was estimated between 6:30 and 7 p.m. on the last day I saw him. So it happened shortly after I left. For a long time, I kicked around the idea that somehow his demise had been caused by the entity that was communicating with him. Yet when I thought on it longer, I remembered something Sebastian had said. The closer I get to death, the stronger the link to my arm becomes. I came to the conclusion that his death truly was natural. That thing didn't cause Sebastian's death. It didn't have to. It just waited for him and had some fun with him while it did so. I completely forgot about Carla Shavers for a few weeks. When I finally looked her up, I found that she was from Sebastian's hometown, and she'd been missing for years. The last time anyone ever saw her, she was walking home from a late-night party. There were very few clues about her disappearance, and she'd been gone so long that most people in the town considered her to be dead. It was shocking to read about, not because some poor girl had disappeared, but because of Sebastian's insinuation that he had something to do with it. I found it impossible to believe that the Sebastian that I knew, with his amazingly friendly disposition, could be directly responsible for anybody's demise. But he'd obviously felt guilty about something. I thought back to some of the conversations we had about his youth, and I remembered him talking about a group of friends he ran with in high school, a time when he was less of a leader and more of a follower. Some of them weren't good people, and a couple of them were downright nasty. I ended up making peace with the fact that Sebastian had probably participated in something malicious. It probably wasn't his idea or even something he wanted to do, but nonetheless, he was present for it. At a minimum, he had information about a missing girl that he never shared with anyone. I contacted the police in his hometown and told them what I knew, which wasn't much, really. Still, it was a lead they could follow up on. When I reported it, I kicked myself for not knowing more. If I hadn't been so desperate to run out of Sebastian's apartment on that final night, maybe I could have gotten more information from him. I saw Sebastian in my dreams every night for months. Little devils with pitchforks would run all over his arms and legs, stabbing them repeatedly. Flames would shoot up around him and cook his skin. "Help me!" he'd scream. The dreams became more and more vivid, until one day I finally woke up with a promise on my lips to try and help him. I drove to Sebastian's hometown, which is about 4 hours away. Through my research, I knew that Carla Schaefer's parents still lived in the area. I called ahead and told them I wanted to speak with them about their daughter, and I was greeted warmly at their door. "Were you a friend of Carla's?" they asked. I explained to them that I never knew Carla and that I was actually a friend of Sebastian's. The police had updated them on the case, so they were already familiar with the name. Then I told them that Sebastian, with his final words, had passed along his apologies for whatever part he'd played in Carla's disappearance. It was clear they weren't ready to hear it. "Thank you for coming out," Mr. Shavers said rather tersely. He was obviously struggling to be polite with me. If Sebastian was ever going to be forgiven, it wasn't going to happen on that day. I couldn't think of any other way I could possibly help Sebastian, and soon my thoughts turned inward. That thing, the entity, it said hello to me. Believe me, it is a very unsettling feeling to know that something so evil has made an effort to personally acknowledge your existence. I wonder if it'll be there waiting for me when I die. But maybe it was just having an easy laugh at my expense. Like so many other things associated with Sebastian's demise, I just don't know for sure. I've taken the time to carefully think back through all my sins. I know I never did anything as bad as Sebastian. Yet, when a friend needed me most, I just left him to die. I might have been able to save him. I, for sure, could have been there to comfort him when he passed, but I wasn't. He died alone and in fear. Some may argue that he deserved it. For all I knew at the time, he was the same innocent Sebastian that he'd always been, and there was plenty of good in him. I hope that my cowardly actions aren't enough to condemn me, and I hope that somewhere, somehow, Sebastian forgives me. I hope you enjoyed The Phantom Arm of Sebastian Culpepper by Thomas O, as performed by yours truly. If you've enjoyed what you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author can be found by visiting our website. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Thomas-O. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/THOMAS-O. As a second reminder, you can find his work published in several short story collections on Amazon, and he is one of 30 featured authors in the Chilling Tales for Dark Knights Anthology, Volume 1, available now in print, with availability soon in audiobook format. As a reminder, if you decide to give tonight's talented author's stories a read, please consider leaving him a quality review and a kind word or a thoughtful public comment and an upvote. Be sure to let him know you heard about him here on this program and that me, Otis Jarvie, sent you. It means more to me than you can imagine, and I'm sure he would very much appreciate it as well. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's talented feature author. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and it would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium, extended edition of tonight's and all of our other podcast episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Knights there.
where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have a chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Story Time, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky
and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschen. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.